Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Khaled Hosseini wrote about how the word senseless so often comes to mind when we talk about murder. It's what people say, a senseless act of violence, a senseless murder. As if you could commit sensible murder. I agree for the most part. I think we can all think of stories that are what we call crimes of passion. But of course, the most common, age-old reasons to kill are lust, revenge, or greed. It's difficult to assign any sort of reasoning to the massacre of the Phillips family of Waynesville, North Carolina. They were the brutal end to what began as a petty crime spree. I think Shakespeare came closer to the pathos in his play Macbeth. All causes shall give away. I am in blood. Stepped in so far that, should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er. Macbeth has too much slaughter and tyranny on his conscience to turn back. The Macbeth quote stood out for me because one of the killers in the Phillips family massacre admitted that once he had shot one man, killing the other people had been easy. He had blood on his hands and saw a point of no return. It's like a part of his soul was just chipped away, the part with any decency or mercy. And yet, this killer would be the one who would become the most spiritual. But then again, there aren't many atheists on death row. Welcome to episode 146, The Phillips Family Massacre. Haywood County, North Carolina is located in the far western corner of the state, 30 miles southeast of the Tennessee border near the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. It's a small county with only about 50,000 residents, the type of place where everyone knows each other, with many of the residents born and raised there. The small town of Waynesville, home to about 9,000 citizens, is still the largest town and county seat of Haywood. It is connected to Interstate 40, giving it easy access to Asheville, North Carolina, and Knoxville, Tennessee. The town is in a valley, nestled between the Great Smoky and Blue Ridge Mountains, with peaks visible from all parts of the town. Waynesville is right on the edge of the county and calls itself the gateway to the Smokies. The Phillips family were one of the oldest and well-known in the community, beginning in the early 1900s when Lewis and Fronnie Phillips brought up four daughters and two sons there. Their son Earl Phillips was born in 1927. As soon as he was 18, he enlisted in the Army towards the end of World War II in 1945. He was discharged after 2 years, and in the 50s, he married a woman named Cora Owens, who also came from another long-time Haywood County family. Earl and Cora had two children, a son Eddie and a daughter Earlene. Cora stayed home to care for the children, while Earl worked as a truck driver for Haywood Oil Company. Every Sunday and Wednesday, Earl and Cora were at their beloved Cove Creek Baptist Church. In the 1970s, Earl became a deacon and later the choir director. The Phillips were always the first to arrive and the last to leave. Their reverend described them as having no enemies. They loved everybody. Earl's nephew Leroy said the Phillips were always there anytime anybody had a problem. He said, "Earl was daddy to a lot of children who didn't have one." Earl and Cora's son, Eddie Lewis Phillips, was born in 1958. In 1999, when our story takes place, Eddie worked as a concrete mixer truck driver for Gary White Trucking Company. And just like his father, Eddie was very active in his church. He was a deacon at First Baptist Church of Lake Junaluska and a member of the ministry team to the community care rest homes. Eddie married Mitzi Blazer, an active church member who was also born in Haywood County in 1955. She worked the late shift at Paxar Corporation, a local plant, and on the side, she ran a hair salon in her home. Eddie and Mitzi had five daughters, Ginger, Connie, Sarah, Tina, and Katie. A few sources state that some of the daughters were from Mitzi's first marriage, but by all accounts, it appears that Eddie treated all of the girls like his own. And Mitzi was said to have absolutely doted on her daughters. The youngest daughter, Katie Renee, was born on July 29, 1985. Like her family, Katie was active in the church. She was a member of the choir and the puppet ministry team. In 1999, she was in the ninth grade at Tuscola High School, where she was also in the choir. The Phillips extended families were later characterized as salt of the earth, good, solid, and nice people. The Asheville Times reported that they enjoyed the simple things in life, like church every Sunday, and they never missed the county fair. The close-knit families loved to just sit down and enjoy a meal together. The Phillips resided in four houses that dotted Earl Lane, a private driveway, winding up a knoll just off Rabbit Skin Road. The lane wasn't named after the Earl in our story, but a different Earl, who was killed in a gunfight many decades before the Phillips time. The house closest to Rabbit Skin Road, at the bottom of Earl Lane, sat vacant. It belonged to Earl's parents, Lewis and Franny, who had recently passed away. Earl's elderly sister, in her 90s, lived in a house further up the drive, and then there was Earl and Cora's house. Earl and Cora had just entered their 70s and were still active in their church and devoted to their children and grandchildren. At the top of the hill sat the home where Eddie, Mitzi, Sarah, Connie, and Katie lived. Their other two daughters, Tina and Ginger, were adults living on their own. One even had a baby, making the delighted Mitzi and Eddie first-time grandparents. On September 30th, 1999, just before 10 p.m., a neighbor named Denny Messer was driving home when he saw Earl Phillips' 1986 Ford truck overturned at the bottom of Earl Lane. Messer turned into the lane so he could tell Earl that his truck had rolled down the steep knoll. As Messer drove up, he passed Mitzi's maroon Saturn, heading back toward Rabbit Skin Road. There were two men inside that Messer didn't recognize. He continued up the drive until something caught his eye. He got out and found Eddie Phillips lying on his back. He'd been shot in the abdomen. Messer later recalled, quote, "I could see air coming out of his mouth because it was cold. His stomach was moving. Eddie tried to say something, but couldn't get it out." Messer went up to the house to call 911, but as he entered Earl and Cora's house, he found more bodies. They'd all been shot as well, but unlike Eddie, none of them were alive. Messer hurried to the phone to call 911, but found that the line had been cut. He ran back out to his vehicle and drove to a nearby convenience store to call for help. On their way to the Phillips house, officers saw a 1974 truck stuck in a ditch off Rabbit Skin Road near the interstate. As they arrived at Earl Lane, they saw Earl's 1986 Ford truck lying upside down. The officers drove up Earl Lane, where they found 41-year-old Eddie still dressed in his work clothes. He had died in the time it took Denny Messer to get to a phone to call for help. Inside Earl and Cora's house, officers found the worst mass homicide in Western North Carolina's history. Three generations of one family had been massacred. There were four members of the Phillips family, all lying in pools of blood, with blood spatter everywhere, on the walls, furniture, ceiling, and floors. The smell of gunpowder was almost overwhelming from the minute you walked in the door, according to one of the first responding officers. The crime scene was horrific to walk through, even for the most seasoned officers. A chief deputy told the Asheville Citizen Times, "It's the worst thing I've seen in my life." 72-year-old Earl and 71-year-old Cora were lying next to each other in front of the couch in the living room, their hands bound at their chests with duct tape. Cora still had rollers and bobby pins in her hair. 44-year-old Mitzi was in front of the stove in the kitchen, with a knife, and an overturned chair beside her. And 14-year-old Katie was in a bathroom, also with a knife beside her. It would seem that Mitzi and her daughter had ran and tried to pitifully arm themselves with knives. Officers searched for Sarah and Connie, who still lived at home with Eddie and Mitzi, but they were nowhere to be found. Thankfully, they had been at work that evening. Autopsies would later show that all of the victims died from shotgun wounds. The person who shot Eddie put the shotgun against the left side of his abdomen. After he fired, the pellet struck multiple organs. He also had blunt force injuries to his head, which were most likely inflicted while he was still alive. His clumsy killer was trying to finish the job after the gruesome gut shot didn't kill Eddie Phillips right away. And horrifically, the killer or killers learned their lesson from Eddie's slow death. Mitzi was shot in the forehead at close range, leaving powder marks around her wound. Katie was shot in the left eye, also at close range. She had raised her left hand to shield herself, leaving injuries to her thumb and ring finger. Whoever shot Earl and Cora also put the barrel of the gun against their skin. Earl was shot in his right temple, and Cora in the corner of the left side of her mouth. She also had defensive wounds on her arms. It was possible that both Earl and Cora had been shot twice, but the medical examiner couldn't be sure due to the extent of the injuries. All he could tell was that both of their palates had damage that could have come from a second shot. A manhunt for the killer or killers immediately ensued, with more than a dozen law enforcement agencies joining. On the ground, they scoured the rural areas surrounding the Phillips homes with dogs. In the sky, they searched via helicopter with heat-seeking equipment. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. While authorities searched for those responsible, word of the massacre spread through Waynesville and Haywood County like wildfire. On the morning of October 1st, less than 3 miles from the Phillips house, Jim Fowler, a longtime friend of the family, decided to search where he lived on Liberty Church Road, just to see if the assailant was hiding out on his property. He grabbed a gun, two of his sons, and their Australian Shepherd mix dog named Bingo. At around 8:30 a.m., as they neared a portable aluminum camper top lying on the ground, Bingo started growling. Then the Fowler saw a man wearing a black and white plaid flannel shirt move under the camper. The men all backed away, and Jim Fowler pointed his gun at the camper as the man emerged. He told the man to put his hands over his head and lay down in a nearby water ditch. Fowler later recalled, "He didn't give me any trouble. He did what I told him." One of Fowler's sons ran to call the police, and Fowler kept his gun on the man until officers arrived and arrested him without incident. At the station, the trespasser informed the officer that he was 25-year-old Charles Roach. Thinking Roach may have killed the Phillips family, he was taken to speak to a detective and an SBI agent. Charles Wesley Roach was born on November 17, 1973, in Roanoke, Virginia, to parents Bonnie and Daniel. He had a sister, Linda, who he was very close to. He always protected her, and they were best friends. They grew up in Burnsville, North Carolina, a small town of around 1,600 people, located about an hour from Waynesville, where the murders took place. The Roach children had a difficult upbringing. They were mentally and physically abused by both of their parents. According to a psychiatrist, Charles's mother, Bonnie, was abusive because she had also had a traumatic childhood. She had witnessed her father, a very violent man, murder her mother by dousing her with gasoline and lighting the fire. Bonnie's grandfather was also a murderer. He fatally stabbed a man in a bar fight. These incidents and the abuse she suffered left Bonnie with severe emotional problems, which then affected her children. She would do things like hold Charles's head under the water while washing his hair. She genuinely thought it was all fun and games, but it wasn't to Charles, who couldn't breathe and thought he was dying. Bonnie also killed a litter of kittens one at a time in front of her children and couldn't understand why it was so upsetting to them. It's unclear what kind of childhood Charles's father Daniel had. However, as an adult, he was in the Navy, which left him a tough disciplinarian even after retirement. He reportedly made the children stand at attention and salute him for long periods of time. And he was also abusive and violent, often whipping his children with a switch until it drew blood. Daniel was also violent towards people outside of the family as well. On Thanksgiving Day, 1982, Daniel and his neighbor, Earl Allen, got into a gunfight. Coincidentally, yet another Earl. After Allen shot into the Roach household and a bullet wounded Charles's sister, Linda, Daniel reacted by shooting Allen 6 times. Luckily, Earl Allen survived, and charges were later dropped against both men. But seeing his father shoot a man 6 times left an impression on 9-year-old Charles. Daniel Roach was also an alcoholic who allegedly forced Charles to drink beer at the age of 6 and liquor by 8 years old. Charles later struggled with alcohol dependency throughout his life. And just like his dad, when Charles drank, he got angry. Later, during a substance abuse evaluation, Charles said he sometimes felt like killing someone, and when he got drunk, he got hateful. For his entire life, Charles Roach had a severe stutter, which his father would ridicule and taunt him for, sometimes even beating him or pulling a gun on him as well. Because of the stutter, Charles saw multiple speech pathologists. One of them later recalled that Charles would come to school upset about his home life. The stress from home made his stutter worse and lowered his self-esteem. When Charles was 16, he was convicted of his first crime, but he didn't stop there. Over the course of the next 9 years, he was convicted of at least 21 crimes, including larceny, DWI, and breaking and entering, among other things. He had also been arrested at least 5 times for assault on his father's sister, ex-wife, with whom he had 2 sons, as well as a girlfriend and a deputy sheriff. Charles's most recent conviction was for assault and larceny, which landed him behind bars for 3 months. He was released on April 27, 1999, and had only managed to stay out of jail until October 1st, when he was arrested in Haywood County. At the time of his arrest, he lived in Hidden Height, a small community in Alexander County, 5 over from Haywood and over 2 hours away from where the murders took place in Waynesville. He had a roommate named Tony Stout. That day, Charles Roach told the detective and SBI agent that he was responsible for the Phillips family massacre. But that wasn't all. He was also responsible for other crimes, including another murder in a different county. Roach told the detective and agent that he didn't need an attorney. He would tell them everything they wanted to know. He said it all started on September 28th when he met a guy he only knew as Chris. Roach didn't know at the time, but Chris's last name was Lippard, and he was born on November 27, 1978. He lived in Statesville, North Carolina, about 20 minutes from where Charles Roach lived, and also a bit over 2 hours from Waynesville. Like Roach, Christopher Lippard had a bad childhood. His family had a history of alcoholism and mental illness. His mother, Donna, abandoned him when he was 2 years old, and he didn't see her again for at least 5 years. And even then, she never played a significant role in his life. With his mother out of the picture, Chris was raised by his grandmother, Aileen, and his father, Tim, who was an alcoholic suffering from bipolar disorder. Aileen later said that Chris was a difficult child from the very beginning. He was diagnosed with ADHD, which led to behavioral issues. Luckily, because Aileen worked in the school system, she was able to have him tested when he was 4. After he was officially diagnosed, Chris was put on medication, which helped. But then everything changed when Chris was 10. His father remarried a woman named Shirley, who had 2 children, both honor students. This was a sore subject for Chris, who had been diagnosed with a learning disability. By the time he entered the eighth grade, Chris was at a second grade writing level, a third grade reading level, and a fifth grade math level. Around the time of his eighth grade year, Chris started using drugs. Things got worse the following year. He attended three different schools, but none of them worked out. He stopped going to class altogether and started committing crimes, which escalated over time. By the time September 1999 rolled around, Chris Lippert had been convicted of at least 34 crimes, including breaking and entering, larceny, and possession. Possibly his worst crime during that time period was committed June 30, 1997, when he slammed a 15-year-old named Charlie into the back seat of a car Chris's girlfriend Daisy was driving. She had driven them to an isolated bridge where Chris's friend Tony Stout was waiting. The boy Charlie was dating Tony Stout's ex-girlfriend, and Tony was jealous. Both Lippert and Stout beat Charlie up badly and then told him not to tell anyone. But authorities soon found out, and Chris was initially charged with kidnapping and assault, but later pleaded down to felonious restraint. Chris Lippert was often sentenced to spend time in juvenile boot camps, though sometimes in jail. In June 1999, at 20 years old, he graduated from Impact, a state-run boot camp for youthful offenders, and then moved back in with his grandmother, Aileen. And according to her, Chris seemed to be doing well at first, but a few months later, he was back to using drugs. But back to October 1st, 1999. Charles Roach sat in a Haywood County police station and detailed the 48-hour crime spree he and Chris Lippert had been on. During the late evening hours of September 28, Roach and his roommate, Tony Stout, were hanging out when Chris Lippert and a guy named Chad Watts showed up. Charles Roach said he had never met Lippert or Watt before that night, but Tony Stout knew Chris Lippert. This was the buddy who had helped him beat up his ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend, Charlie, a couple of years earlier. Lippert and Chad Watt said they had been driving around drinking and were hoping Tony Stout had some marijuana. But he didn't have any, so Charles Roach suggested that they go rob a drug dealer with his gun. He knew some drug dealers they could rob and said he would take them there. Roach grabbed his sawed-off 20-gauge shotgun, and all four men piled into Chad Watt's car. They drove around drinking beer and eventually ditched their plan to rob a dealer. As the sun rose, they were headed down a rural Alexander County back road when Lippert ran over something. They pulled over to investigate and found that the gas tank had been punctured. Chad Watt was pissed when his car broke down. He started arguing with Charles Roach, and things quickly turned violent. Chris Lippert joined in, but not to help his buddy Chad Watt. Instead, he helped Roach beat up Chad. Then, Tony Stout joined in, and it was 3-1. When they were done, Roach and Stout threw Chad in the trunk of his own car. Then they started discussing how they would have to kill him now. They'd beaten him too badly not to. But then they realized the shotgun was in the trunk with Chad. They opened the trunk and asked him to hand them the gun. And Chad did. Then they let Chad out of the trunk, and the four men started walking toward a main road. Roach said he knew this area well. He had grown up there. While in a wooded area near the Elk Shoals Creek, Roach and Chad Watt started arguing again. Charles Roach told Chad Watt he was going to kill him, and then made him dig his own grave in the creek bank beside a tree. Roach admitted that he broke Chad's neck with his bare hands and then shot him twice in the face. Then Roach, Lippert, and Stout buried Watt, covering him with brush. Later, authorities would find Watt's body under a log near Charles's old childhood home. Then the three men walked to a main road and hitched a ride to Stout and Roach's place in Hidden Night. Later, they disposed of evidence, and Lippert went back to his grandparents' place in Statesville. Roach told investigators, "When I shot that guy, Chad, it fucked with my mind. They say after you kill the first time, the others are easy, and that's true." Because the murder of Chad Watt played a smaller role in this story, there isn't much out there about him besides the fact that he grew up in Charlotte and was living with his father in Statesville at the time of his death. where he had unfortunately met Chris Lippard. Watt's mother, Cherie, described her son to the Charlotte Observer. Chad was not an angel, but he was making some huge efforts to turn things around for himself. He had so much potential. He was very musical, and he was very artistic. The next morning, September 30th, Chris Lippard stole a 1970 Ford truck and then headed to Tony Stout and Charles Roach's place, about 20 minutes away, where they all discussed fleeing the state. It was only a matter of time before somebody found Chad Watt's body. In the end, it was only Lippard and Roach who decided they would leave, since they had been the ones who committed the murder. Before they fled Statesville, Lippard and Roach went to Walmart to steal two pairs of boots. In the parking lot, they stole a license plate off a truck similar to the 1970 Ford Lippard was driving. As Lippard and Roach drove out of city limits, they made several stops to steal items from vehicles, officially beginning their crime spree. When they had enough money, they stopped at a liquor store for two cases of beer. Even though Lippard was the only one who knew how to drive, he drank three times as many beers as Roach. The two men hopped on Interstate 40, traveling toward the Tennessee border. If they made it, it would be about a five-hour drive. But about a half hour in, they stopped to pull off at a rest area in Hickory, North Carolina. They went into the men's restroom and pretended to use a urinal while waiting for someone they could rob to come in. After a man named Bart Long walked into a stall and sat on the toilet, Roach went into the stall next to him, reached over the top of the partition, and sprayed him with pepper spray. Then Roach kicked in the door and put Long in a sleeper hold while he tried to steal Long's wallet. But Bart Long didn't carry a wallet, so Roach began beating him. The poor man started yelling for help, and as folks came running, Lippard and Roach had to run back to their stolen truck. They got back on the interstate and traveled around 100 miles, less than 2 hours, before stopping again. Now, in Haywood County, the two men exited the interstate at Jonathan Creek Road. Lippard tried to make a three-point turn near the Rabbit Skin Road intersection, but he was drunk, so he ended up backing the truck off the road and into a ditch. The truck got stuck, so the two men grabbed what remained of their last case of beer and tried to hitch a ride, but no one stopped. Lippard and Roach figured they'd need a new car to steal, so they started walking down Rabbit Skin Road. They saw lights on in the house at the top of Earl Lane. So they walked up the steep knoll, which brought them to Earl and Cora Phillips's home. Roach told investigators that Lippard went into the house while he waited outside. After he heard screaming, Roach said he ran in and found Cora lying on the living room floor. He claimed Lippard was holding a shotgun to her head, while Earl pleaded with him to spare his wife's life. Roach said he tried to calm the situation by telling Earl that no one was going to die. Roach then asked Earl to show him the cabinet where he kept his guns. Roach took a 20-gauge shotgun and some shells, and then he cut the phone line. After binding Earl and Cora's hands together with duct tape, they left in Earl's 1986 Ford truck. As they backed down Earl Lane, they passed a maroon Saturn, heading towards the Phillips' house. They didn't know it at the time, but it was Mitzi, Eddie, and Katie coming back from the county fair. Before the two men even reached the bottom of Earl Lane, master drunken criminal Chris Lippard crashed and flipped the truck on the steep driveway. Roach broke the passenger window out so they could climb through, and then he started gathering up their belongings and handed Lippard the shotgun he had stolen from Earl. Roach said Lippard went back to the Phillips' house to steal another vehicle while he waited in the nearby woods. That's where he was when he said he heard Lippard yelling, "Charles, get him off me. He's going to kill me. Charles, don't leave me, Charles." So he said he ran to the Phillips' yard and found Eddie Phillips fighting with Lippard for control of Earl's shotgun. Roach admitted he walked up to Eddie and shot him once in the chest with the sawed-off shotgun he was carrying. He reloaded, and the two men went up to the Phillips home. Roach and Lippard found Mitzi standing in the doorway, refusing to let them get inside. She was protecting Katie, who had run inside with her mom. Roach said he broke the door down as Mitzi ran to the kitchen and he ran after her. In front of the oven, he shot Mitzi once in the face. Then he saw Katie run into the bathroom, so he hunted her down. When he opened the bathroom door, he found her sitting on the toilet. He shot her once in the side of the head. Roach left the bathroom and found Lippard in the living room with Earl and Cora. Earl was slumped over while Cora was lying on the floor with blood coming from her head. While detailing this part of the story to investigators, Roach first said that Lippard had shot both Earl and Cora once in the head. But later on, during the same interview, Roach confessed to also shooting Earl and Cora. However, he said he only shot them after Lippard did. They were already dead when he fired his shots. With all the witnesses dead, Lippard and Roach stole the maroon Saturn. As they drove down Earl Lane, they passed a car. They didn't know at the time, but the car belonged to Danny Messer, the man who would find the Phillips family dead. Lippard and Roach got back on the interstate, but only made it about a mile before drunken Chris Lippard hit a concrete divider, which disabled the car. Seriously, this guy would have been better off letting Roach drive, even if he didn't know how. Instead of continuing their spree, Lippard and Roach split up. Lippard crossed the barrier at the opposite side of the road, while Roach left on the side with the guardrail. He quickly found a place to hide under Jim Fowler's camper, which then led to his arrest. Following his confession, Roach was held in jail on 5 counts of murder until he could be officially indicted. The next order of business for investigators was tracking down Roach's accomplice, who at this point they only knew as Chris. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Finding the perfect skincare routine for my olive, though aging, skin is never easy. I have naturally oily skin, but time and Mother Nature have conspired to give me dry patches. But that all changed when I started using Proven Skincare. Proven Skincare's formulas are rooted in the world's largest beauty database, the Skin Genome Project, and the winner of MIT's AI Technology of the Year Award. They analyzed over 20,000 skincare ingredients from 10,000 products and over 28 million testimonials. All of this analysis results in Proven Skincare's custom 3-step system that actually works, including a personalized cleanser, day moisturizer with SPF, and personalized night cream. This simple and effective system replaces my shelf full of products. Plus, your formulations are updated every 8 weeks to evolve with you, based on changes in your skin or environment, and your skin's acclimation to active ingredients. This time of year, my skin is drier, so my Proven formula has my skin hydrated and glowing. Give your skin exactly what it needs with Proven Skincare. Go to provenskincare.com to take the free skin genome quiz and use code SFTC for $20 off your first order. That's provenskincare.com, code SFTC for $20 off your first order. provenskincare.com, code SFTC. Just like your skin, your hair is completely unique and deserves products that address its specific needs. That's why I think you'll love Function of Beauty. Function of Beauty is the world's first fully customizable hair care that creates individually filled shampoos, conditioners, styling, and treatment formulas based on your hair now and where you want it to go. Here's how it works. First, take the quick hair quiz to build your hair profile and select 5 hair goals like lengthen, volumize, and oil control. Does your hair get frizzy in the winter? Winter, but oily in the summer? Function formulations are meant to be changed when your needs change. Next, choose your color and fragrance, or go dye or fragrance free. Then get your freshly filled formula delivered straight to your door and prepare for good hair days ahead. Say goodbye to generic hair care for good today. Go to functionofbeauty.com/SFTC to take your hair goals quiz and you'll save 25% on your first order. Go to functionofbeauty.com/SFTC to let them know you heard about it from our show and to get 25% off your first order. That's functionofbeauty.com/SFTC to take your hair quiz and save 25% off your first order. I love to find new wines, but wandering around my local shops trying to find something to suit my taste is daunting. That's why I love getting my personalized wines delivered right to my door with First Leaf. First Leaf is a wine club that curates and ships wines that are personalized to your tastes, allowing you to discover wines from 5 continents and 12 countries. When you rate the wine you receive, First Leaf learns more about your palate. We complete the survey after every shipment, and the next box is always something new and exactly suited to our tastes. This month, we got a wonderful Cabernet called Che Boluda from Argentina and a lovely vintage Sauvignon Blanc from California called Strata Blue. My husband and I really enjoy the variety First Leaf chooses for us. First Leaf is so confident you'll love the wine that they have a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you receive a bottle that isn't exactly what you were hoping for, First Leaf will credit your account. If you love finding and tasting new wine, First Leaf is a no-brainer. Join today and you'll get 6 bottles of wine for $29.95 and free shipping. Just go to tryfirstleaf.com/SFTC. That's 6 bottles of wine for $29.95 and free shipping at tryfirstleaf.com/SFTC. Authorities released a sketch of Chris and asked the public to keep a lookout for him. He was described as being around 6'1", 180 pounds, 19 to 25 years old, with mostly blonde hair and a barbed wire tattoo around his right bicep. It wasn't long before they received a tip that someone with Chris's description was seen near the Jonathan Creek Road exit at around the time of the murders. The person had hitched a ride on the back of a semi, which was heading east. Then authorities received tips from other callers who said they had seen the man on the back of the semi for around 100 miles. He hopped off in Hickory. That would be where he and Roach had beaten and tried to rob Bart Long at the rest stop. He had come full circle back. Their last confirmed sighting came from tipsters who saw Chris board a Greyhound bus in Hickory on October 2nd. Investigators found that the bus was heading to New Orleans, with many stops along the way. They realized that Chris could be anywhere at this point, so the manhunt continued. Luckily for authorities, following his confession to police, Roach made a few phone calls to figure out Chris's last name. As soon as he found out it was Lippard, he passed the info along to investigators. Now that they knew Chris's last name, they looked into him and found that he had actually been arrested in Newton, 20 minutes from Hickory, around 3 hours after the massacre. At around 1 a.m., he was arrested for public drunkenness after security guards found him hanging around outside of a food warehouse. He had been released at around 6 a.m. after he sobered up. Because he hadn't been identified as a suspect in the massacre yet, no one knew they had just freed one of the men responsible. On October 5th, authorities released 20-year-old Chris Lippard's photo in hopes that the public could help track him down. 2 days later, Governor Jim Hunt authorized a $10,000 reward for information leading to Lippard's arrest. On October 8th, America's Most Wanted was just about to release a segment on Lippard when he made the mistake of calling his Uncle Danny, who had caller ID. Danny knew authorities were looking for his nephew, so he wrote down the number and passed it along. Investigators tracked the number to an apartment near the French Quarter in New Orleans. There, officers found Chris Lippard and arrested him without incident. When Haywood County residents found out Lippard had been arrested, they were thankful, but apprehensive, especially in Waynesville. Murder was non-existent in their small town. No one could recall a single murder ever happening there. Earl's cousin, Robert Rose, told the Asheville Citizen-Times, quote, "You see all this happening on the news everywhere else, but you don't think about it happening here in the mountains. This is the worst thing we've had happen around here." The owner of the local funeral home told the Charlotte Observer, "We've just never had anything like this in Haywood County, ever." Before the Phillips family massacre, the town was so small, no one ever locked the doors to their cars or homes. Now, residents were on edge. A deacon at Earl and Cora's church told the Herald Sun, "If I'm sitting on the back porch on a quiet night and a dog barks, I jump up. That's something we never did around here." The local Walmart saw an increase in gun and ammo purchases, with many people citing the massacre as their reason for the purchases. Residents were scared that something like the massacre could happen again. A neighbor of the Phillips told the Asheville Citizen-Times, "You think if it happens once, it can happen again, right? We will never be the same. We'll just never get over it." Another neighbor said, "It's been very traumatic. It does make you a lot more cautious." Of course, no one was more affected by the massacre than the surviving Phillips family members. especially the ones who lived off Earl Lane. None of them could bear to set foot in their own homes. Eventually, the properties were put up for sale, and a 4-foot wooden cross memorial was erected at the foot of the knoll. On October 12th, 4 days after his arrest, Chris Lippard was interviewed in New Orleans by an FBI agent. He waived his rights and said that while he didn't kill anyone, he did see some things. Lippard's story matched Roach's for the most part. However, there were some discrepancies. Lippard started his confession with the September 29th murder of Chad Watt, someone he had only met recently after helping him with a broken-down car. In fact, Lippard knew so little about Watt that he kept calling him Todd instead of Chad throughout his confession. Lippard said that he, Chad Watt, Charles Roach, and Tony Stout all drove around drinking looking for a drug dealer to rob. Then he told mostly the same story as Roach's, that they had beat up Chad Watt after his car broke down. But that's when his story started to differ. Lippard told investigators he yelled at Chad Watt to run, but claimed that Charles Roach chased him down, caught him, then told him to get on his knees and pray for his life. He said that Charles Roach and Tony Stout beat Chad some more and then decided it was finally time to kill him. Knowing his friend was going to die, Lippard claimed that he asked Roach to shoot him in the eye instead of the chest so he would die immediately. Roach did what Lippard asked. He put the shotgun to Chad Watt's eye and pulled the trigger. Chad was instantly killed. But then Lippard said he wanted to make sure Chad didn't suffer, so he took the shotgun and fired a shot into his head as well, which doesn't make much sense, especially since we know Charles Roach confessed to breaking Chad's neck before shooting him twice. But moving on with Lippard's story. Again, it mostly aligned with Charles Roach's until he got to the massacre of the Phillips family. After getting their truck stuck on Rabbit Skin Road, Lippard and Roach went to a nearby house because it had lights on. This would be Earl and Cora's house. Roach told Lippard to sit under a tree while he went inside. When Lippard heard screams, he ran in. That's when he found Earl and Cora on the floor. While Roach stole money and guns, Cora was screaming, which he said upset Charles Roach. Lippard said that he may have tried to keep Cora quiet by hitting her head against the floor several times. But Cora didn't quiet down, so while Lippard held Cora's head, Roach shot her and then Earl. They stole Earl's truck, and as Lippard backed down the steep driveway, Roach told him, "Slow down, you're going to wreck us." Lippard claimed he looked over at Roach and saw him pointing a shotgun at him. That's when Lippard lost control and wrecked. They got out of the truck, Roach gave Lippard a shotgun he had stolen from Earl, and they headed back up the knoll to find another vehicle. But then, Eddie Phillips came out of nowhere and grabbed Lippard by the hair. He called out to Roach to help him. He said Roach ran up, shot Eddie with a sawed-off shotgun, and then went inside the house. Lippard stayed outside, where he heard screams and 2 to 3 more gunshots. He said Roach then came back out and they got in the Saturn, which Lippard quickly wrecked again as he always did. Then the two men went their separate ways and never saw each other again. Chris Lippard told investigators that he made his way to a Hickory bus stop where he started panhandling. It doesn't appear that he admitted to hitching a ride on the back of a semi, but the prosecution maintained at trial that that's what he did. On October 1st, Lippard was still panhandling when a local man named Ricky Prestwood asked what happened. Lippard's clothes were bloody, his eyes were puffy, and his hands and arms were covered in scratches. Lippard said his dad had punched him in the nose and then kicked him out, and he hadn't eaten in days. Prestwood had been homeless and felt sorry for Lippard. So he bought Lippard lunch and some clothes at the Salvation Army. Lippard told Prestwood that he had family in New Orleans, so he bought him a bus ticket there. According to the FBI agent, Lippard first started off the interview by saying he shot the old lady, meaning Cora, once, but that she was already dead when he did it. Then he changed his story and said he didn't know if he had shot anyone. He wanted to get it clear in his head before he officially said he had shot Cora. Lippert's final unofficial statement was that he didn't shoot anyone or he didn't remember shooting anyone. He did say that he knew he had ruined his life and that he may get lethal injection, but he was glad Charles Roach was off the streets because he was, quote, a psycho and a sicko. Now that they had spoken with both assailants, authorities had two confessions they needed to corroborate. For the most part, Roach's confession seemed to be fairly accurate. It was Lippert's they had a problem with. The physical evidence didn't match up with his account of what happened to the Phillips family. If you remember, Charles Roach admitted to shooting Cora and Earl, but only after Chris Lippert had shot them. On the other hand, Lippert told the FBI agent that he shot Cora and Earl, but only after Roach had shot them. Then later, Lippert recanted that statement altogether. Authorities knew from the autopsy results that it was possible Lippert and Roach both shot Cora and Earl. The medical examiner had found defects in the roofs of their mouths, which suggested that they may also have been shot there. However, the ME did not find an exit wound that directly corresponded to the possible wound on Earl's palate, and Cora's head was so damaged he was less certain there had been a shot to the roof of her mouth. The issue for the prosecution was that Lippert recanted his statement about shooting Cora and Earl. That meant they had to prove that Lippert really did shoot them. Authorities knew that two guns were used during the murders, Roach's sawed-off shotgun and Earl's stolen shotgun. However, they couldn't tell which gun was used to kill which victim. All they knew was that 7 shells had been recovered in or near the Phillips home. 2 were found in the living room and 1 was found near Earl's wrecked truck. All of those had been fired by Earl's shotgun, which was found near Eddie's body. It had been left there after his struggle with Lippert. The other 4 shells were fired by Roach's sawed-off shotgun, which was found in Mitzi's wrecked Saturn. The issue with these shells is that Lippert admitted he had been carrying around Earl's shotgun, but ultimately claimed that he had not shot anyone. If that was true, then why had Earl's shotgun been fired 3 times, twice where Cora and Earl were killed, and once by the truck? And to make matters worse for Lippert, Earl and Cora's blood were found on Earl's shotgun, which means it was most likely the gun used to murder them. The next big inconsistency investigators had to work through was the fact that under Eddie's body, authorities found a bloody striped golf shirt that investigators believed had come off during his struggle with the killer. Since Charles Roach was found still wearing all of his clothes, that meant the golf shirt had to belong to the other killer. The blood from the shirt was tested and found to be Cora's, which told investigators that whoever was wearing that shirt was most likely the person who killed Cora. Investigators were unable to officially tie the shirt to Chris Lippert by DNA, but it still seemed very likely that it was his, since when he had been spotted after the massacre, he was shirtless. And to bolster their theory, authorities were able to establish that Cora's DNA was not found on Charles Roach's clothing. On October 13th, Chris Lippert was extradited back to North Carolina. 5 days later, Lippert and Roach were each indicted for the first-degree murder of all 5 Phillips family members, plus 2 counts of robbery with a dangerous weapon and 2 counts of first-degree burglary. I'm going to pause now for a final commercial break. When all was said and done, a jury would be allowed to pick from a wide range of verdicts: guilty of first-degree premeditated murder, first-degree murder under the felony murder rule, second-degree murder, or not guilty. The felony murder rule says a defendant can be held responsible for the death of anyone who dies during the commission of a felony, such as robbery or kidnapping. This meant that for the jury to find Lippert guilty of first-degree felony murder, the prosecution did not have to prove Lippert actually shot and killed all 5 victims. They just had to prove that the victims died while Lippert committed a felony, such as robbery, burglary, or kidnapping. The prosecution later announced that they would be seeking the death penalty against Roach and Lippert, who would be tried separately. Lippert, Roach, and Tony Stout were also charged with the kidnapping and murder of Chad Watt and Alexander County. On June 25, 2000, jury selection for Christopher Lippert's trial for the Phillips family massacre began in Haywood County. Lippert's defense had motioned to have the trial moved because they felt almost all of the county's 50,000 residents had already decided Lippert and Roach were guilty and that they should be executed. The defense argued that all the residents talk about is the Phillips case and what they'd like to do to these people. And he wasn't lying. Residents were very open about their opinions, even to the media. A local man told the Charlotte Observer, quote, "People say they didn't give the Phillips a trial. Why should they get a trial? Most people think they should hang them and not even worry about trying them." The judge denied the motion to change venues, but after pushback from the defense, he eventually agreed to allow the jury pool to come from nearby Buncombe County. They would be bused 30 miles to Haywood County every day. On July 6th, opening statements began. The prosecution told the jury that Lippert and Roach were two peas in the same murderous pod, who acted together as friends and companions during their crime spree, which began after Roach and Lippert killed Chad Watt. Evidence of Chad Watt's death was allowed into trial because it was the reason why Roach and Lippert tried to flee North Carolina to begin with, which eventually led them to the Phillips house. Throughout most of the trial, the prosecution did not put forth a theory of what exactly happened to the Phillips family. This is most likely because they didn't have to prove who killed who, just that five people were killed while two people were committing felonies together. Instead, prosecution waited until their closing argument rebuttal to officially tell the jury that they believed wholeheartedly that Lippert was the one who shot and killed Cora and Earl, and there was evidence to prove so. The shotgun shells, the blood on the shotgun, and the bloody shirt. With all that being said, the prosecution told the jury that Lippert should be found guilty of all five murders because he had acted with Roach, making him just as culpable as the man who pulled the trigger in the deaths of Mitzi, Eddie, and Katie. The prosecution told the jury that Lippert was going to say he was too drunk to form the necessary intent behind premeditation, but that he was a liar. Following the massacre, Lippert rode 100 miles on a semi, meaning he wasn't as drunk as he was making himself out to be. The prosecution added, quote, "If there was any intoxication, it was the intoxication on the blood of the Phillips family." The defense told the jury that 20-year-old Chris Lippert was a natural follower who was trying to stay out of trouble when he met the older Charles Roach on September 28, 1999. That meeting led him into a nightmare where he witnessed Roach kill six people while he was drunk and out of control. The defense said, "The evidence will show Chris Lippert killed no one. The first person to react the way you're going to react was Chris Lippert." Lippert did testify on his own behalf. He said that after they went on the run, he drank three beers for every one Roach drank. He was so drunk, he could barely remember what happened. All he knew was that Charles Roach masterminded the murders of the Phillips family. Lippert told the jury that he waited outside while Roach went inside the Phillips house. After hearing screams and gunshots, Lippert went in and found Earl and Cora on the living room floor. He testified that he put his hands on Cora's head to quiet her. As he did that, Roach shot her, and then Earl. Lippert did not remember fighting with Eddie on the lawn, and he didn't see Roach shoot Eddie. He only recalled being thrown to the ground and having his hair pulled. Lippert claimed he did not see Mitzi or Katie, and he did not recall being in the maroon Saturn, but he also didn't deny it. On July 21st, 2000, after deliberating for 4.5 hours, the jury found Christopher Lippert guilty of 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of second-degree murder for Katie. He now officially faced the death penalty. Earl and Cora's daughter, Earlene, told the Charlotte Observer that the verdict was so much a relief and no matter what sentence he received, he would never see the light of day again. During the penalty phase to decide if Lippert should receive life in prison or the death penalty, the prosecution presented multiple aggravating factors for why he should be executed. His previous convictions for violent offenses, he committed the murders while fleeing arrest, that the deaths were heinous and cruel, and more. In hopes of getting their client life in prison, the defense presented mitigating factors that focused on evidence of Lippard's rough childhood. The defense said they were not trying to excuse the fact that Lippard killed people. They were only trying to show his state of mind to convince the jury that he should not be executed. On July 28th, after deliberating for 5 hours, the jury was at a 6-6 deadlock. North Carolina law forced the judge to automatically sentence Chris Lippard to 4 life sentences for the first-degree murder convictions and to 18 to 23 years for second-degree murder. According to the Asheville Citizen-Times, when he heard about the deadlock, Lippard appeared stunned that he no longer faced lethal injection or the gas chamber. His family hugged each other and cried. The Phillips family was disappointed that Lippard didn't get the death penalty, but knowing he would die in prison was better than nothing. Following the trial, the jury did not speak to the press, so it was unclear if they believed Lippard killed anyone. But we can assume they didn't, because the defense told the jury that if they didn't believe Lippard pulled the trigger, that was reason enough not to give him the death penalty. Next up was Charles Roach's trial, which would also be held in Haywood County. Just like in Lippard's trial, the same judge ruled that the jury pool was to be selected from Buncombe County. On April 5, 2001, open arguments began. The prosecution's case was very similar to Lippard's, except in this trial, they said Roach was responsible for the deaths of all 5 victims. They said Roach shot Mitzi, Katie, Earl, and Cora because they had been witnesses to the murder of Eddie. They added that after he was arrested, Charles Roach confessed to shooting all 5 family members. The defense openly admitted that Roach killed Eddie, Mitzi, and Katie. However, the murders were second degree, not first, because he had diminished capacity for 2 reasons. 1, because he had been drinking and doing drugs, which caused him to act on impulse. The defense said that at the time of the killings, Roach and Lippard had smoked pot, snorted cat tranquilizer, drunk vodka and schnapps, and were making their way through 2 cases of beer. The second reason for diminished capacity was due to his mental state, which a forensic psychologist testified to. She said Roach suffered from a chronic anxiety disorder, had a low average intelligence, and had experienced a violent upbringing. She said Roach exhibited features typical of a dependent personality disorder, meaning that he has a high need for affection and security from other individuals. That's why the defense said Roach followed Lippard, who they insisted was the real leader. And that was why Roach falsely confessed to shooting all 5 victims. He hadn't shot Cora and Earl. He was just covering for Lippard, like he had when he said he shot Chad Watt twice in the face. Later, the prosecution said Charles Roach did not have diminished capacity, and they made a big to-do about the psychologist's $5,000 fee. We all know how expert testimony works, but not all average jury members do, especially not back then, before the true crime genre really went wild. It was easy for a small-town prosecutor to say a diagnosis was paid for rather than genuine. And because Roach didn't take the stand, the defense outlined what happened for the jury. After they got the car stuck on Rabbit Skin Road, Charles Roach wanted to hitchhike and get away. But Chris Lippard wouldn't let him. He wanted to find a vehicle, so they walked up Earl Lane to the Phillips house. Lippard went inside while Roach waited outside. After hearing screaming, Roach went in and found Lippard with his knee on top of Cora. He supposedly told Earl that no one would be hurt. Then he bound Cora and Earl with duct tape. The defense added that during this time, Roach stopped Lippard from shooting Cora at least once, and Earl thanked him. Lippard and Roach then stole 2 guns, money, and the keys to Earl's truck. But soon after, they wrecked it and crawled out. That's when Roach saw Lippard walking back to the house. By this time, Eddie, Mitzi, and Katie had returned home from the fair and found Cora and Earl inside bound with duct tape. Roach then heard Lippard yell out, "Get him off me," as he struggled with Eddie outside the house. Roach then made his way to the yard, and then he did shoot Eddie, Mitzi, and Katie, but at no point did he shoot Earl and Cora. That was all Chris Lippard. The defense pointed out that when they wrecked the Saturn and went their separate ways, Lippard was the one that kept running. Roach only went a short distance away and confessed as soon as he was arrested. The prosecutor asked the jury to imagine how the victims individually must have felt before they were killed, adding that the victims in those five caskets are crying out from their graves that justice be rendered. The prosecution said if the adult victims could be at the trial, they would ask Charles Roach, "Why Katie? Take us, Charles Roach, but why Katie?" On April 18, 2001, after deliberating for 3 hours, the jury found 27-year-old Charles Roach guilty of the first-degree murders of all five Phillips family members. They felt that Roach did not kill Cora and Earl, but he was found guilty under the felony murder rule, since they were killed while a felony was committed. For the murders of Eddie, Mitzi, and Katie, the jury felt Roach did kill them while acting with premeditation and under the felony murder rule. According to the Charlotte Observer, Charles Roach bit his lip at one point while the verdict was read. Otherwise, he was calm and quiet. He now faced the death penalty. Four of the surviving Phillips family members testified during the penalty phase of Roach's trial, something they had not done at Lippard's, which some speculate is maybe why he did not receive the death penalty. Three of the four surviving daughters of Mitzi and Eddie testified about having trouble sleeping, and how when they did sleep, they had nightmares. Sarah Phillips described having nightmares where Katie reached out, asking for help, but Sarah couldn't help her. The daughters also testified about no longer feeling safe and having panic attacks. Connie said, "I get real panicky when I hear sirens go off because I think it's another of my family members being killed." Cora and Earl's daughter, Erlene, testified about the loss she faced without her parents. She talked about how she used to talk to her parents every morning on the phone. Now she aches and hurts, adding, "To me, it will never be over." The prosecution submitted four aggravating circumstances to prove why Roach deserved to die, adding, "There can never be a more appropriate case. The murders were committed to avoid being arrested. The murders were especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel. The murders were committed with someone else, and the murders were committed for financial gain." The defense submitted four mitigating circumstances for why Roach's life should be spared. The murders were committed while Roach was under the influence of mental disturbance. Roach's capacity to appreciate the criminality of his conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law was impaired. Roach was young at the time of the crime, they said, though I will point out he was 25 years old, not exactly a teenager. And finally, the last mitigating factor was that Roach helped authorities arrest Chris Lippard, which was true. The defense added, "A sentence of death confirms for Charles everything his dad has said and done to him. There is nothing about killing Charles that will bring closure." In addition to the mitigating circumstances, the defense had a minister testify that Roach had let the Lord come into his life in prison. Roach later said Earl Phillips showed him what it means to have faith. Just before Roach fired the shotgun, Earl said, "God bless you, son." Which is interesting, since the defense insisted that Charles Roach did not kill Earl or Cora. The minister testified that finding the Lord had changed Roach's character, but on cross-examination, the prosecution brought up how Roach continued his aggressive behavior even after finding God, like tearing a telephone off the wall and throwing food and water in jail. On April 25th, after deliberating for 6.5 hours, the jury recommended that Roach be sentenced to death for the murders of Mitzi and Katie, and life without parole for each of the other three murders. The prosecution later theorized that the jury chose death for Mitzi and Katie because Roach had hunted them down in the house. He didn't have to kill them. Charles Roach did not look upset or surprised by the verdict. According to his attorneys, he had expected it. Roach's sister Linda told the Asheville Citizen Times, quote, "Charles has told me over and over and over that if he gets death, he's right with the Lord." She added, "He's told me several times that he's thought about the Phillips family and he feels real bad for them." After everything was over, the judge, who had presided over both trials, approached the Phillips family and told them, "I want to thank you for your demeanor. It's been remarkable. When you go to those grave sites, you can tell them that you stood tall, stood steady, and stood strong. I hope your tomorrows are a whole lot better than your yesterdays." On March 28, 2002, in order to avoid the death penalty, Lippard and Roach both pleaded guilty to the first-degree kidnapping and murder of Chad Watt. They were both sentenced to life without parole. Later that year, Tony Stout, the man who was with Lippard and Roach during the murder of Chad Watt, pleaded guilty to being an accessory after the fact to first-degree murder and to first-degree kidnapping. He was sentenced to a maximum of 16 and a half years in prison and was released in February 2014. In March 2020, Tony Stout was convicted of credit card theft and drug possession, but was only sentenced to probation. On September 3, 2002, the Court of Appeals of North Carolina affirmed Chris Lippard's convictions and sentences for the Phillips family massacre. As of this recording, he is 43 years old and is incarcerated in the Alexander Correctional Institute in North Carolina. Since his arrival in prison, he has committed 89 infractions, including disobeying orders, inhaling a substance, assaulting staff with a weapon, high-risk acts, substance possession, fighting, lock tampering, escaping, and so much more. On May 7, 2004, the Supreme Court of North Carolina affirmed Charles Roach's convictions and sentences for the Phillips family massacre, and his execution was scheduled for October 22. Following the court's decision, Charles Roach told his attorney to stop any further appeals process he was entitled to. He was going to accept his fate and be executed in October. In an exclusive interview, Roach told the Charlotte Observer that while he could extend the date of execution by continuing to appeal, he wanted to spare the Phillips family more pain and suffering. Because he did not know what to say to the relatives of his victims, he wanted his death to show his remorse, adding, "It only takes words to say you're sorry, but it takes your heart to show it." Charles Roach said he still thought about the murders, and he kept pictures of the Phillips family, which he had cut out of newspapers, to remind him of the person he never wants to be again. Roach said that although he was drunk and high at the time, he still remembered every detail. Thousands of times, he'd asked himself why he did what he did, but he hadn't found the reason. He added, "I feel that I took the hurt and pain that I feel in my heart, and instead of facing it, I took it out on people that didn't deserve what happened." Charles Roach admitted to the Observer that he killed all five members of the Phillips family. With that being said, Lippard participated and was the first one to enter the house, and Roach said he thought Chris Lippard needed to take responsibility for that. On October 22nd at 2 a.m., 30-year-old Charles Wesley Roach was executed. In a final statement, Roach had written, quote, "I can only hope and pray the pain and hurt I caused you will be healed as I give my life as a key to forgiveness. May God's love shine on you." Or, an eye for five eyes, if you will. It is difficult to feel anything for Charles Roach or Chris Lippard, though I wonder if we will ever know the truth. Roach admitted to the murders. Lippard denied them, though blood evidence tied him to at least shooting Cora Phillips. Charles confessed while Chris ran. Chris Lippard called Charles Roach a psycho and a sicko. Who do we believe? Do we really care now? Does it matter? I do think it's important to note that both men suffered from generational trauma and abuse, the vicious cycle that begets so many killers. But there is always a choice. 600 mourners from Waynesville and other parts of Haywood County came to the joint visitation for Earl, Cora, Eddie, Mitzi, and Katie. Earl and Cora were in their golden years, becoming great-grandparents and doting on their large family. And they died in fear and horror, probably knowing that their killers had already either chased down Mitzi and Katie or would. Eddie Phillips died trying to save his family. Mitzi also tried to block the door to save her daughter. and then she and Katie grab knives to defend themselves against shotguns before they were hunted down. It is sickening to think of the sudden, incredible violence they all experienced that day. How terrified Katie Phillips was as she waited in that bathroom, hearing the shot that killed her mother, and then pleading for her own life. At many points in these murders, Roach and Lippard could have stopped. They could have let Chad Watts go. That seems to be the original bloodlust that set them off. The original killing that made five more innocent people, just five more bodies. A senseless tragedy, in the truest sense of that word. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Haley Gray, with additional writing by me. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic artist by Coley Horner. If you have any case suggestions, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, and go to the Listener Suggestion tab. If you have submitted a case suggestion in the last few months, please resubmit it on the website. I was overwhelmed by email when I came back from my sick leave and never caught up. This is the best way for me to get to those little-known cases y'all always send me. Please remember that I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. With three platforms to manage, that is also very overwhelming for me. I hope you understand. But please do come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. I much prefer spending my social media time in our lovely group. We do, of course, discuss true crime, not just Southern Fried, but all kinds. But it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.